Thomas. However, if you do it with betas and alphas, it's different as bogey. So, the answer is not that easy. First look at it, and then find out. I don't believe that just turning the object makes the trick explain. Atricia.
Yeah, I got a problem with all of that.
Do you know the exact orientation of each of the four sources that you put onto the film, John? Is question number one. And now, if, for instance, source number one gave you the greatest coma at, say, the 12 o'clock position, it'd be very interesting to hold your Geiger counter at the 12 o'clock position off to one side of the source while it's sitting on the film and compare the Geiger counter to the 6 o'clock position. That way, you wouldn't even have to wait the 30 hours to see if the Geiger counter can see the difference. Over to you, John. KQRIW.
Oh, very true, Dick, but you have to, the count up is so slow that it would take a long time to do that, to get an accurate reading and averaging. So I could put it on like a pencil and rotate it with the Geiger counter fixed and, you know, rotate it 5 degrees at a time and count the readings over, say, a minute and do it that way, yes. But here's my issue. Film, there's nothing wrong with that film. It is beautifully flat, and if it had something wrong, if you took a picture, it would have all kinds of shades of gray screwed up because of the film not being correct. So it's not the film, and I do believe it's x-rays that it's being exposed to. And under the coin, we pick it up, and when you look at the film, under the coin, it's evenly exposed. So if it was lacking energy in one particular area, that shouldn't have exposed it as much. There should have been a shade difference. That's the way I'm thinking, Dick. I don't know about that. That sounds good to you.
When you hold your Geiger counter near that source, how many counts per minute or second do you get, John? I'm talking about the number of clicks that you hear. Go ahead.
It sounds similar to when you're watching a movie and you see Geiger counter and you hear something like that. They're almost continuous. So it's, but you have to take a meter reading to get a count. And they all respond basically the same. Little bit of difference. If I want to get the same count, I got to get a little closer to some of them. The depleted uranium, I think, is the weakest.
So you're worried that if you're hearing counts that are almost continuous when you're directly in front of the source, and now you're thinking that off to one side where the coma was, you're not going to hear a significant difference in counts. The human ear, if I'm hearing 10 counts per second at 12 o'clock and 5 counts per second at 6 o'clock, I'm pretty sure that even before I watch the needle move, I'm going to hear that difference, John. Go ahead.
Amen. Dick, you might be right. I haven't done that, but I will do that and see if I can detect a favored side to the radiation. It's there. I can see it on the film, but why it's there, I don't know. But you may be right. It may be just it's not a homogeneous mix perfectly, which could account for it. But I still have issues with it favoring that much and not showing that same coma effect, at least a little wider. But somebody else in there, pick them up, Dick. Back to you. KC2WGB.
I have an explanation for that.
Yeah, I'll pick up the caller in a second. John, was there a distinctive mark on each of your sources so that you're fairly sure what was the orientation when you put them on the film? Over to you.
Absolutely, Dick. They're all marked, and I photographed those marks, so I can reposition them anytime I need to.
Who's the person who said I want to make a comment? Who was that?
KD2IXP.
KD2IXP. I guess it's you, John, number two. Go ahead, John.
I am by far not an expert in fine radiological sources. My expertise runs to mass quantities and weapons of mass destruction. But the container, the holder for the sample, is it possible that the container or the holder sample has become contaminated over the duration of its containment of the source, that the container itself is producing these comas?
That's a tough one. Let's see what John has to say on that one.
John, and good evening. To my knowledge, there's no marks on them. They've never been dropped, which I can understand if it was dropped, things could shift. But they're encased in a, I imagine it's some type of thick mylar, something like that. I don't know what's covering them, but they're not in metal cases. It's some type of plastic. But no scratches, no marks, and they're less than a year old. So, don't know.
Is there any way, John, that you know what the actual source looks like? Is the source a random chunk of chipped off material that's buried in something that looks like plaster of Paris, and now it's contained inside of a outer container? I mean, if you could X-ray the actual specimen, would the real radioactive chunk inside be a symmetric object? Is there any way you could know that? Over here, John.
From what it looks like, because it's transparent, it looks like a small disc, small inside, very thin, and it looks linear. You know, it doesn't look like it's thicker on one end or thinner on another end, nothing like that. They look like they were stamped out or pressed into that basic unit. Yeah, strange.
Yeah, but the clear plastic that you're looking at, that I'm having trouble believing that's the source. Is the source some tiny little dot of material that's glued to that piece of clear plastic? Go ahead.
I don't know how it's encapsulated in this thing, but it's about this. It's a little larger than a large eraser on a pencil. That's about the diameter. And let me see, it may be 3 millimeters thick.
But you said it's transparent. If it was transparent, you would actually see the real object that's emitting. I suspect you can't see the real object that's emitting. Is that true?
I can see it, but I don't know if it's a distorted view or not, but it looks smooth and linear. It looks like it was machined and then placed in that unit. Now, I have other ones. They're not certified calibration, and they just look like a chunk of something that was put in there. They look a little differently. I haven't tested those on the film, but I was using these. But as far as I can tell, they look like a molded piece of whatever it is. Now, whether it's distributed uniformly within the mold, that I don't know.
Is this source melted into a piece of plexiglass, so to speak? Go ahead.
Sort of like that, yes. It's, I don't know how the process of sealing it in there. It could be injection mold, I'm not sure. But they may have even had two wafers and just cemented them together, although I don't see a seam. They could have done it in some type of an oven, I'm not sure.
Wes had a comment. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, the calibration sources that I have are about 1 inch in diameter and about 3/16 in thickness. Those are pieces of plastic were right in the middle. You have the specimen. Now, the more I think about it, the more I come to the conclusion that your foil, your film is not acting to the gamma. If you have a specimen that actually makes gamma. That's important, what is that you have. But it reacts to every existing X-ray that comes from the specimen. Now, in the typical camera, how is that being done? The old cameras have used a radioactive substance in order to create a film. And then it was replaced with the X-ray tube. Let me drop. So in order, well, so then you had a source that is on the top of the person lying on the bed. And right behind that person, from the bottom of the person lying on the bed, there was a cassette with the film that was placed. In order to get an equal response from the film, the collimator was used. Imagine that your specimen is shooting uneven amount of radiation of any kind in different directions. So now, you cannot say that 30 degrees from the center of the film in the direct vertical line, you're going to have that many of the counts, or say 60 degrees in the other. uneven. So what I did is I have a set of the beautiful collimators. It's something like the honey bean, something that is made out of the lead and has a tiny holes in it. Now this thing has a different thickness. So we imagine that you have a plaster of the honey bean and it's made out of lead. The taller that plaster it is, the taller that honey bean is, the more good it is to just let direct radiation to go through the holes down to the person's body, to the foam. And that's how actually they make a perfect picture of the right size. But that requires from the specimen to be perfectly large also as well. But anyhow, easy way, I can give one of my collimators and then you put your radioactive substance on the top of it and then you see how your foil responds. So your foil probably doesn't see gammas, if there is a gamma source, but sees the X-ray. Now I forgot that another one could be a neutron. Neutrons could also be seen, but there are so many, so much to explain about. Edward,
have you ever put any of these calibrated sources, I think they're calibrated, in front of your Geiger counter? I think you said yes, and I think you said you get almost a continuous count, in which case, if there is a directional characteristic, I think your ear and your meter is going to tell you pretty fast with your Geiger counter. And is your radiation detector a Geiger counter, a scintillation counter, or do you have both? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yes, I do have both, but the Geiger counter is more directive. I can do it with the Geiger counter. I don't think the scintillator will work as well. It's too broad. I don't think I'll get a concentration there. The probe I can control.
Straight down below your circular dot of the source, the eraser-sized opening at the bottom, so to speak, you got full exposure. What percentage of full exposure was the coma off to, say, the 12 o'clock position? Over to you, John.
Underneath, I would say, on the bottom, I had at least 85% exposure. And the coma, of course, it changed as it traveled outward. It did not expose the outer limits as much as the closer area, of course, makes sense. But the close area was equal to the lower area, 85%, maybe could be 90%, but I could definitely see a radiation of gray on the bottom. Then it got darker and darker as the coma went out. Very visible, but darker. I would say it maybe went from 85% exposure to maybe 50 or 60% exposure.
And you confused me a little bit when you said darker. I presume this is ordinary negative, so the places where it's exposed, it turned black. Is that true?
Yes. This film, it'll turn it black, and then if you make a contact print, that's where you can see the light and pick up the little tiny particles that you really can't see too well on the negative.
Oh-ho. So you're not looking at the negative, you're looking at the print that was made from the negative. Interesting.
I looked at both, examined both.
And you're reasonably sure that your contact print was not over or underexposed. And by the way, when you're making a contact print from an 8x10 chunk of film, what do you use as the illumination source, John?
I use my light box. It's maybe 12 by 12 inches, and the visible light base is maybe 11 by 11 inches, has like a 1-inch border around it.
And you're fairly sure that the illumination from your light box is an extremely uniform illumination across the whole dimensions of the negative?
Absolutely, Dick. Yep. And the protective lenses were all clean on the light box.
Both your Geiger counter and rotating those sources and repeating the going to rotate with them.
I agree. I think it will. I'm not positive, but I will make that test. It's just a mystery. The fact that the major reason I think they're going to rotate is because they're in different directions to begin with. If they were all in the same direction, then I would say maybe that's an outside influence. That'll be interesting. Back to you, Dick.
So the overflow coma is what I'm going to call it. In general, it was random from sample number 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Random directions. But I'm guessing that that overflow coma is going to repeat, and you know the orientation, you had it during that first exposure. How did you choose 30 hours as the exposure time, John?
I have a little calculator that works with the film, and you pick an average radiation source, and it gives you, you know, a targeting. And it was telling me, you know, get it within maybe 10 hours to anywhere up to 50 hours. So I took a target in between. I knew I would have some results, but I wasn't sure. Now, maybe if I reduce the time, maybe I'll see a better transition and be able to track it, that I don't know.
When you and I saw that movie done by the guy from Australia, I can't think of his name right now, he was measuring the radiation levels in millisieverts or microsieverts. I think it was millisieverts. I think it was microsieverts. But when you're measuring the intensity of a source, what units do they use, John? Go ahead.
This is an old one. It's millirads. The newer ones are in sieverts, and you can convert that. There's a chart for that. And also, you have to, on the certified sources, they tell you what the distance, different type of detectors that you're using, prove the radiation level.
Yeah, to my knowledge, millisieverts is a power flux density. Call it particles per square centimeter, so to speak. And you're only going to get that number of millisieverts at some standard distance. So that if you measure the millisieverts from your source and you did it at 1 centimeter versus 2 centimeters, I'm pretty sure you would see a different number of millisieverts. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
You know, Dick, that's interesting. I have a flux density meter made by HP. That may have some interesting results, too. I should try that.
Yeah, almost everything with radiation obeys the inverse square law. So millisieverts will only have meaning at some particular distance. Therefore, there's got to be some other system of units that measures the source. And I'm wondering what that system of units is.
Well, all the later ones I know come with either milli or microsieverts. I don't see any rad indications on them anymore. Those were the old days.
When they have a leakage at a nuclear power station, and they try to tell you how much material has leaked, I'm trying to remember what units they use. I don't think it was millisieverts or microsieverts. What were those units, if you happen to remember?
Yeah, I believe there's 3 or 4 different units. I'm not sure. I know Glenn would know, because he works with that stuff. And I know he works in all in sieverts, but there is at least 4 different methods of doing it. Rad's only one of them.
Yeah, see, if I was testing a 1-watt transmitter going into an isotropic antenna, at some particular distance, I'm going to measure, let me pick a number, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. And if I double the distance, I'm going to get 1/4 of that number of milliwatts per square centimeter. So that's measuring power flux density at a given distance. But in the case of a transmitter, I can also tell you that the transmitter is emitting 1 watt into an isotropic antenna. There's got to be an equivalent for the radiation world where they tell you the real power at the source independent of distance. When it comes to radioactive material being released from a nuclear power station, I'm pretty sure they use that second system of units. Then I don't think they're telling you millisieverts, because that would only have meaning at a particular distance. There's a way of rating the watts of the source, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Now, that may very well be true. I'm not familiar with that or what that measurement is. But as you know, as you bring the detector closer to the source, of course, the radiation levels go up and up. So I guess that's just a basic indication of the total parameters you're exposed to, and you just don't go any closer when you get to a certain level. So, you know, that's the simple stuff. But you're probably right, and maybe the manufacturer can tell me something when I talk to them.
I think all we got to do is read some of the news reports of the radiation material that was released from Fukushima or Three Mile Island or Chernobyl. I'm pretty sure that other system of units, of how many watts was the transmitter, so to speak. There's got to be a way of rating that. And in theory, your source has a number printed on it. And I think you're telling me the millisieverts is the units that they use. But that millisieverts would only have meaning at a particular distance. Maybe there's a standard distance that you're always supposed to use when you use that kind of source, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, there is a note that comes with them, and the testing procedure is explained there, and it gives you the instrument they used and the distance from the source. That's easily traceable. And I'm trying to think, is there any notes? I don't know. I'll just keep trying until I can try to make some sense out of it. But it was interesting.
Let's see, one of the units that I've heard about is Becquerel, I think, but there I'm not sure. We'll recognize it when we hear it.
I think you're right, that is one. So Curie amount.
That sounds like it, Curie. How many Curies of radiation? I think that's it. I think that's the equivalent of watts of a transmitter, John. Curie, sounds like it.
I think they usually give you the millicuries. I've never used that scale, never had to, but yeah, that is one of them also.
And curie may be one of those kinds of units where it's the equivalent of watts to the transmitter, which is independent of distance. If I know I'm measuring a 1 watt transmitter, and if I know it's going into an isotropic antenna, whether I make the measurement at 1 foot or 100 foot, as long as I know the number of feet I made the measurement, I can refer it back to a equivalent isotropic radiated power, EIRP. And the radiation world has got to have a similar set of units that the RF world has. So in the case of a broadcast transmitter, they'll sometimes say 1,000 volts per meter at 1,000 feet, or they'll say effective isotropic radiated power, 50 kilowatts.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And that's a good idea, because if you have a reading, so many millicuries, and you know you're a certain distance, determine the energy at the source from that reading, from what I understand.
Whitey White,
NBR. Okay, Hank first. Go ahead, Hank.
All right, guys. I'm not very knowledgeable about this, but while you were talking, I looked up the definition of a millirad, and then I compared that to the definition of a millisievert. And it seems like they're talking about two different things, if I understand it right, with the rad being something that is like what you're talking about, Dick, where they talk about the total number of joules per gram of matter. But the sievert is described, or the millisievert is described, as being the average dose of radiation that you would normally receive as an individual in the United States in one calendar year. So I really don't understand how they can compare the two, if either of you guys can come up with an answer on that.
We're slowly deriving an answer. Who was the other person that wanted to say something? Give us your call letters and name.
Good evening, gentlemen. Hamill here, QTH is Westchester, and call at 10-2 NPR, November 2, November, Bravo, Romeo.
N2 NBR. Start off with your name, sir, and tell us what you know about the subject.
Hail, here is John. I have an old Heath kit radiation monitor. It's the RM4, put out, of course, when Heath kit was around. And the glossary, they talk about various words. One of them might be suggestive to your thinking. One is ionization radiation. One is Antigen or Rentgen. Rentgen, and there's a definition for that if you'd like me to read it.
Okay. Read us that Rentgen definition, please.
The spelling is R-O-E-N-T-G-E-N, and it's pronounced Rentgen, I guess. The basic unit of measurement on the ionization produced by gamma or X-rays. One rentgen is the exposure to these rays that will produce one electrostatic unit of charge in one cubic centimeter of dry air. And it goes on to say 1,000 millirentgens, I can't pronounce that right. This unit has not been defined for alpha or beta radiation, but maybe that's the direction you want to go. I don't know.
Yeah, that's talking about an amount of exposure to one cubic centimeter of air is what I think you said, which sounds like a power flux density, similar to, in the RF world, milliwatts per square centimeter. There's another system of units that's used in the RF world, which is, what can I think of it right now? Watts per kilogram. Yeah, watts per kilogram, which is used with reference to cell phones. I think we're allowed 1.6 watts per kilogram of cell phone exposure, which is now starting to get very specific. But in either case, in the RF world, I can refer everything back to an effective isotropic radiated power back at the real transmitter. How many watts is coming out of the transmitter? Maybe that's a system of units that you were talking about earlier, John, which I've already forgotten. Not Becquerel, not Sievert. What is that other system of units you just thought of, John? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
The millicurie?
That's it, curie. I think curie is a specific amount of power right at the source, irrespective of distance. That's my guess. If we do enough reading, we're going to find out more about it.
Got to get over to Joe.
Yeah. Joe, you had a further question. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Yes, I did. Thank you, W2RYY. This has to do with the wire length ratio. I want to understand, is that length of wire to divide it into diameter of the wire in inches? Is that how that ratio works? That's one part of the question. Answer that first, and I'll ask you the second part of it.
You didn't say, but I'm going to guess you're talking about the Brown and Woodward curves, where each one of those curves on that XY plot of frequency horizontal and impedance vertical, each one of those curves has got a certain A to D ratio, 1,000, 500, 200, and so on. That is length to diameter ratio, and that ratio for a monopole, the Brown and Woodward curves, everything is referred to a monopole. And so you're going to change things by 2 to 1 when it comes to impedance or A to D or whatever for a dipole. Now, if I'm measuring the ratio of the length to diameter, it doesn't matter if I measure that in centimeters, inches, or miles. The length to diameter ratio in a common set of units for length and diameter is going to be the same number. It's a unitless number, John. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Alright, so if I understand that correctly, you got to keep the units the same. In other words, it's not something like, a particular length of wire might be 67 feet divided by the diameter, and say the diameter is 0.101 inches in decimal. It does not work like that?
The way you asked the question is neither a yes or a no answer. I'm going to repeat. If you're measuring the diameter in 0.1 inches, then you better measure the length also in inches. Yes, you're going to use the exact same units for the diameter and the length. Now, it doesn't matter what units you use, as long as you use the same units for length and diameter, you're always going to come up with the same ratio. That ratio is a unitless number. Over to you, John.
Metrics, man.
Okay, so if I keep the ratio the same, I'm going to come up with a certain number, like feet converted to get that number, how the second part of the question is, with that particular number, how do you determine the Q of that wire? Or is that an easy way to do that, a difficult way? How does that actually work?
Once you know that number of A to D ratio, that allows you to choose one of those particular curves that's on that graph. And just to give you an example, each of those graphs, the highest number there is 1,000. 1,000 of length to diameter ratio. When you and I build an 80-meter dipole out of 14-gauge wire, the real number of length to diameter of that is something close to 10,000. See how the curves are getting more and more steep as you go to a higher and higher ratio, bigger length to diameter ratio. Therefore, you can see that the Q is proportional to the slope of the reactance curve. You'll notice that with high A to D numbers, the slope of the reactance curve starts getting very steep. Only when you get down to an A to D of about 4 does it start flattening out. So the slope is proportional to Q. A higher slope is going to be a higher Q. Now, if you want to convert that into Q, you can start off with a resonant length. That means the horizontal axis is going to be 90 degrees. Let me drop. And now you can go some percentage higher or lower in frequency, which is really going to be going from 90. It's going to be going from 90 degrees to 95 degrees, or from 90 degrees to 85 degrees. You will see the rate of change of reactance, and maybe the reactance goes from 0 ohms of reactance to 30 ohms of reactance in my example. And now, if I've got an antenna where the resistive component is matched, assume it to be for a monopole 37 ohms. The resistive component is 37 ohms. The reactive component went from 0 ohms of reactance to 30 ohms of reactance. So now, at the new frequency, my antenna is 37 plus 37R plus 30X. And when I take that equation for the impedance of the antenna, and I now convert that into, let me think what I would do. First of all, you have to define what is your definition of Q. By that I mean, some people, Q, one of the definitions, there's six definitions of Q. One of the definitions of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. Okay, but you've got to define what you call bandwidth. Is the limit of your bandwidth where it hits 2 to 1 Vizwa, or does it hit the 5 to 1 Vizwa? 5.5 to 1 Vizwa is where half the power is reflected. 2 to 1 Vizwa is where roughly 10% of the power is reflected. Once you define what's the maximum standing wave ratio you will tolerate, then you have a definition of bandwidth. And once you calculate that bandwidth and divide it into center frequency, you know the Q. And so, and once you...
Repeater, time out.
Once you know the equation for the impedance of your antenna, some amount of R and some amount of X, that's a complex number. If you want, I'll tell you how to calculate what is the reflection coefficient once you know the exact impedance of the antenna. Maybe you already know that. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
What I was basically getting at with the definition of Q is basically to determine the bandwidth of the piece of wire being used at a certain frequency. And I do understand what you're talking about. You can go so far in frequency, plus or minus from that, before you're going to get a certain amount of change in the performance of that wire.
It's not change of performance. The wire will have the exact same performance if you re-impedance match it. But you're not impedance matching it. You're calculating reflection coefficient. If you started off with an impedance match at center frequency, and now you move to the frequency where your definition of bandwidth is where it hits 2 to 1, that's where the reflection coefficient is 9.5 dB. Okay? What impedance of R plus X gives you 9.5 dB of reflection coefficient? That's a certain number of degrees of movement along that graph, along the horizontal axis. You're going to go from the 90 degree point to maybe the 95 degree point. That's a 5% change in frequency, so to speak. Is that starting to make a little more sense than Joe? Over to you, K2LAW.
Yes, it is. What I was simply trying to establish is how much of a ratio of changing the diameter to the length do I have to go before it starts making getting to a point where you don't need to go anymore because you really can't gain a heck of a lot as far as lowering the Q. That's probably what I was basically getting at. For example, if you use a piece of wire 66 feet long, like one half of an 80 meter dipole, and you're using copper weld, which is about 26 gauge, something like that, 24, 26 gauge, something like that, that gives you a fairly narrow Q, fairly high, fairly narrow bandwidth. You go to bigger wire, the Q is going to drop, and the bandwidth is going to increase. I want to find out, relatively, how much I can go with the change the gauge of the wire to a larger gauge before I reach a point of diminishing returns versus the weight of the wire. That's what this whole discussion is sort of going in, that in what direction I'm going and why I want to know all this stuff.
Yeah, that's a good discussion, Joe. And you're not going to like the answer. You can see from the curve you're looking at, of the reactance curve of Brown and Woodward, you can see that 1,000 has got a very steep curve, and you know that your 80-meter dipole really has a 10,000 A to D. You'll notice that when you go from 1,000 to 100, the curve is less steep. When you go from 100 to 10, the curve is less steep. When you go down to the curve of 4, it becomes almost a horizontal line with a squiggle to it. So the Q is going to get lower and lower until the length to diameter ratio is approximately 4. You ain't going to do that at 80 meters. That is the law of diminishing returns. If weight and price of the copper was no object, then you would love the length to diameter ratio to be 4 if you can get there. In the case of a 900 megacycle antenna made out of sheet metal, making the length to diameter ratio of 4, let me drop it. The sheet metal placed in, copper tape mounted on a piece of plastic, a 4-to-1 ratio is easy. On 80 meters, where a half-wave dipole is 132 feet long, no way, Jose, unless you're making a very big birdcage. Over to you, Joe.
I can understand that. Well, here's the last part of the question, and this is just directly to you, not to Ned. When you were working on a particular project where you had to make an antenna resonate between 902 to 928, what if another technical requirement was, say, for example, you had to use a frequency band of almost double that with a similar bandwidth in megahertz, and you had to put two antennas within one enclosure? Would that be an easy challenge or a hard challenge for you?
First of all, that was essentially the original challenge. Because of spatial diversity they desired, they wanted 6 dB of gain out of each antenna, and they wanted both antennas to be contained into a handheld device, something that looks like a handheld calculator. Okay, a 6 dB gain antenna at 900 megacycles must have an effective capture area of an 8-inch diameter circle. That's what 6 dB of gain is. Effective capture area is an 8-inch diameter circle. Okay? And you don't want the two antennas to be coupled to each other. Therefore, these pair of antennas, each is an 8-inch diameter circle, you're going to set them 8 inches apart. Okay? But they wanted them inside the enclosure, and the enclosure was only 4 inches wide. No way, Jose. They were way beyond the laws of physics. It took a while, but I eventually convinced them of two things. Number one, you're not going to put two antennas in there. You can put two antennas in there if you want to, but the coupling coefficient, you'd like it to be 20 dB isolated. It's going to be 1.5 dB isolated. No way. You think you've got spatial diversity. When the two antennas are coupled that tightly, you put a watt into one antenna, you've really got 3/4 of a watt already going into the other antenna, if you know what I mean, because they're so tightly coupled. They aren't isolated, so you don't have spatial diversity. They had to give up on that. Second of all, the way way, with all the laws of physics I know of, let me drop it. The best way that I could create 6 dB of gain was that Yagi-like structure that I could give you the patent number where you can look it up and you can see this strange-looking thing. At first, you will never recognize it as a three-element Yagi. That's what it really is. But it's made out of sheet metal and it's got this wild shape to it. But once you achieve that wild shape, which was found by purely empirical testing techniques with a very well-calibrated VNA, that thing across the whole 902 to 928, more than 20 dB down. Occasionally, on a good one, I got them 30 dB down across the whole bandwidth. Now, there was a requirement for a broader band antenna. We managed to make a different kind of antenna. It wasn't a three-element Yagi. It was a mixture of dipole plus loop with very careful coupling between the two, very wide pieces of sheet metal. In those cases, the pieces of sheet metal were, I think, 1.5 inches wide on an antenna that resonates 4 inches long. Anyhow, that antenna was 150 megahertz wide, 30 dB down. And that's one of the other patents. Over to you, Joe, K2RAW.
Was that also 900 and something megahertz?
Yay, barely. 950 was the center. 150 megs of bandwidth. When you see that on a Smith chart, you don't know what the hell you're looking at. You start off from 80 megs away. It was plus or minus 75 megs. You start off 80 megs away. The dot is way off near the perimeter of the Smith chart. Within the next couple of megacycles, the dot dives into the center, and it stays in the center for the next 150 megacycles. It doesn't make circles around the center. It just goes to the center and stays there. We called it the stalled impedance phenomena. And you take your Smith chart and you expand it by 5 to 1 or 10 to 1 in diameter. So you can see the center, and it looks the same. Strange antenna. It goes quite far beyond what people thought was possible. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
And I would bet that particular project, or that section of that project, time-wise, took a while to implement something like that, didn't it?
Yes and no. To find that solution, which we never expected, we know we needed more bandwidth. We had to get both the European and the American frequencies. The European frequencies are 864, the American frequency is 915. We wanted to cover those two frequencies. So we knew we wanted more bandwidth because to do it with one antenna design instead of two antenna designs, it gives you a huge stocking requirement improvement, if you know what I mean. You don't have to stock two sets of antennas. So we wanted that extra, let me think, 864 to 915, what is it, an extra 45 megs or something like that. We wanted 45 megs of extra bandwidth. When we finally found a solution, we didn't have 45 megs, we had 150. That was the good news. We found the solution in a week. We got a hell of a lot more bandwidth than we needed. We got a hell of a lot better visual than we needed. That was the easy part. To now make it manufacturable within the constraints of what they were conventionally doing, that took a number of months. To make it manufacturable within the constraints of the manufacturing department, that's where we spend 95% of the time. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Okay, last part of the question. That doesn't have to do with what I'm doing directly, but just out of curiosity. Have you ever tried, or did you ever have time to take that design and try and say, like, half the frequency and see if you can get this accomplished the same thing? Nominally, you know, the thing would be absolutely be bigger in physical five, but did you ever try lowering it to actually see what you could get?
Because of the way the philosophy, the physics of how this thing worked, once we made it work, it was a 150 meg wide antenna. I only needed 60 megs. We got 150. If you now told me, make it only 60 megs wide instead of 150, what would you change? Nothing. It doesn't become bigger. It doesn't become smaller. You just use a sloppier matching transformer. It used a mini circuits matching transformer because you're starting off with a 50 ohm transmitter, And the antenna itself, I'm not sure what the exact number, I think the antenna was a 20 ohm impedance. So I had to make an impedance match, a broadband impedance match from 50 ohms to 20 ohms. That happened to be a mini circuits transformer. You could have used a sloppier transformer, but mini circuits transformers are so damn cheap. I think the damn thing was like a dollar and a half. Why would you bother using a cheaper one, if you know what I mean? Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
Okay, I guess what I was getting, did you ever try to scale an antenna to like half the frequency, or say double the frequency, to see if you got the same performance out of it, relatively?
Had no need to do that, because this was the an RFID antenna. Only an RFID antenna needs this ridiculously high 20 or 30 dB reflection coefficient across every one of those megacycles, because in order to be license free, you have to continuously be frequency hopping across that whole frequency region. 902 to 928, you break it up into 50 cells, and you have to use a pseudo-random code and hit every one of those 50 cells per a couple of seconds, if you know what I mean. Every few milliseconds, you have to hop to another frequency. So that means that somebody's cordless telephone on one of those frequencies doesn't get jammed. He doesn't even know what's going on, if you know what I mean, because you spend so little time on his frequency. If he misses a couple of cycles of the voice he's listening to, he'll never know it. So that's the reason it's license-free. It's the reason you have to be doing the hopping. And we needed that very high VISWR reflection coefficient so that the transmitter, which is a CW radar, is not jamming your own receiver during the time you're transmitting and receiving. And if you want to make it more narrow band than that design, you don't gain anything. It doesn't become smaller. It just becomes a sloppier transformer. But the transformer already was so cheap, why bother doing that? Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
Well, what I was getting at, if you made this beam work at that frequency range, and you got 150 megs of bandwidth, if you took the frequency in half, would you get 75 megs of bandwidth out of the antenna, theoretically?
Q is a ratio of center frequency to bandwidth. You go to half the frequency, the exact same Q, you're going to get the exact same ratio. So half the frequency, half the bandwidth. Bear in mind now that the first antenna I told you about was a three-element Yagi, 902 to 928. This 150 meg thing was not a Yagi. It was a loop dipole-like combination made out of one very wide piece of sheet metal with an exotic shape. Once again, I give you the patent number. You can look at the antenna if you want to. It's something like you've never seen before. It's a crazy-looking shape. It is not a Yagi. It doesn't have any significant gain. It wasn't made for gain. It was made for bandwidth. Over to you, John, or Joe, K2LAW.
I guess the point of
Kenny,
I guess you're not seeing it. I understand it wasn't within your realm to explore something at half the frequency. I mean, making something like that for, say, commercial use, because, you know, nominally for commercial use, antennas are about 20 megahertz wide on UHF, say, like 450 to 470, 470 to 494, approximately, and then, like, another range to go up higher than that. They don't cover too far in frequency. Antennas I've seen, like, especially multi-element antennas, directional arrays, in the commercial variety, they don't cover 450 to 520. That's what I was getting at. But I guess you didn't. If you didn't have to go that way and develop something to work down there, you wouldn't have known.
If you and I were building a station master-like antenna, although this thing has got huge bandwidth, you wouldn't like its antenna pattern. You wouldn't use it there. And all the laws of antennas tell me that if you half the dimensions of every single dimension, you'll get twice the frequency and the exact same performance. We're out of time. This was TechNet number 1584. Bye-bye, you guys. We're going to settle all these things next week. You believe that, we'll tell you another. KC2WGB, the tie on the ribbons. K2RW. Over to you, John. Have a nice week, and maybe we'll talk during the week.
Okay, Dick, and I'll let you know how we make out. KC2WGB. I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net and for the interesting questions, and hope to hear everybody back next week. If all goes well, we should be here. KC2WGB. Thank you, and good night. Night, Paul, Dick. Talk to you soon. KC2WGB clear.
One last word, Joe. tell them the volume you've dedicated to building an antenna. What's the maximum bandwidth you can get out of the antenna, or what's the minimum Q you can get? This antenna I just described to you, that 150 meg wide thing, it exceeds that that criteria by about 3 to 1. Each person who has got 20 years of experience building antennas, you tell them what performance that has, and they all say, it's impossible. To which you then say, okay, read the patent. And it was issued. You mean to tell me the patent office is lying? Bye-bye for now, Joe. KQRIW.
I guess what it goes to prove is give you a road and force, and you can do almost anything.
Not quite. There were definite limits. However, we did push the state of the art almost 2 to 1 beyond what other people have done, simply because everyone else does it with computer modeling. This antenna cannot be computer modeled. You got the solution in your hand, you test it on a Rodin Schwartz, you test it on a Hewlett Packard, you test it on an Agilent, you get the exact same answer on all three. You then put it on a real RFID reader, and it runs like a charm. It's real. And yet all of the computer models, you take that antenna and plug it into a computer model, and it says, it ain't doing that. The computer model can't handle something that wide. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
That's very interesting. Okay. Well, as you say, bye-bye for now.
As they say in California, later, dude.
Major Warrior, White Clear.
K2JIS. K2JIS test.
And to XJN, KC2WGB.
Yes, sir.
K2JAS, are you calling us?
Yes, Dick, I was trying to reach you, but I don't know, I'm having some kind of problem here, not being able to transmit when I click the transmit, and I did have a question, but I guess it'll wait till next week.
Did I hear you on 147.21 earlier today? Are you the same guy?
Negative. Was not me.
Okay. You say your call letter so fast. I think I'm hearing K2 Juliet Alpha Sierra. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that is correct. Kilo 2 Juliet Alpha Sierra. Roger, in Port St. Lucie, Florida now.
Okay, if you've got a brief question, why don't you ask it right now, Roger.
Thank you. I've been waiting such a long time. I have this R5 vertical that I have up, and I'm trying to adjust the resonant frequency of all five bands, and I have an MFJ, sort of like a dipper, a 259 dipper, and when I connect it to the antenna about, which is in position, and I'm using a 3 foot piece of RG8 to connect it. When I touch the 259, the SWR goes down. So it's exhibiting what would you call hand effect, and I don't know if that's making any significant difference, but it's certainly screwing up my readings.
Yeah, I think the R5 needs a significant number of ground plane radials. And when you have the right number of ground plane radials, wires are properly adjusted and attached, I think the so-called hot coax problem almost disappears. If your coax is hot, maybe that's part of what's going on. On top of that, measuring resonant frequency with a tunnel dipper is what I think the MFJ is, a tunnel diode, grid tip oscillator, that gives you approximately a resonance, but a much better way of really finding what the antenna is doing is by using buying an antenna analyzer or a Berg wattmeter, and you measure the reflected power. And so to most people, the point of minimum reflected power is defined as the word resonance. And I think you're trying to tune it to your favorite portion of each one of those bands. Is that approximately what's going on, Roger? K2 Juliet Alpha Sierra, St. Lucie, K2 RIW, New My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick, that's exactly right. I am trying to tune it to the portion of the band, of each of the bands that I want it resonant at. And this antenna requires no significant amount of ground radials. It is grounded with an 8-foot ground rod, and it's sitting 10 feet off the ground on top of a piece of 1¾-inch EMT electrical tubing. At the base of the antenna, there are seven 48-inch radials, but those are not resonant radials the way you would ordinarily visualize radials. So let's just say it's an end-fed half-wave antenna with a matching section and requires no radials. And I was just trying to start tuning it. What I haven't finished, I haven't started tuning. All I've done is measuring. Back to you.
Yeah, I wonder if you have access to a antenna analyzer or a bird watt meter or some other method of measuring standing wave ratio. Using your real transmitter and measuring standing wave ratio, I think is going to give you a better answer. The average way a guy uses a grid dip oscillator to measure resonance is he takes the shack end of the transmission line, puts a loop of wire there, and then couples his antenna, his grid dip meter to that loop of wire. And that's it gives you an approximate answer, not a very good answer. The other instrumentation would do a better job. Is that approximately the way you did it, Roger? Over to you, K2RIW.
Okay, K2RIW, K2JAS, portable 4. Let me see how I can explain it. I have a Millen grid dip meter and a Millen antenna impedance bridge back in New Jersey, and maybe I can go and get those. But I also have down here a Jones micromatch, which I can put in the line and read the SWR at the transmitter end. I can also put the coupler up at the base of the antenna and do that, but then it requires that somebody else operate the transmitter and start playing with the frequency, and that is getting unwieldy. So the MFJ tuner seems like a godsend with a digital readout, but I wasn't expecting the coupling effect of my hand on the thing to be throwing it off. So I can live with it. I'm just wondering what was going on. Back to you.
If an antenna has standing wave ratio, and if you got a low enough loss in the feed line, the standing wave ratio at the antenna and the standing wave ratio in the shack will be essentially the same. So you can make all the measurements in the shack. If your antenna tuner has enough range that it can make your transmitter happy, that's hunky-dory. So, do you think your antenna tuner has enough range? And I think you can make all of these measurements in that, Roger. K2JAS, portable 4, K2RIW.
Okay, K2JAS, portable 4. Yes, I have a Johnson matchbox, the smaller of the two, and that works just fine, and it'll tune the line to one-to-one. That's not a problem. I was trying to do it without the matchbox and just the transmitter alone.